This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at sevillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more available on demand at sevillepodcast.com. Now available through email, sign up in our upper left-hand corner. I'm Dan Daniels. As Virginia's population ages, so does its need for geriatric care. Yet doctors trained in geriatric care are increasingly hard to find. On June 11, 2008, the Senior Statesman of Virginia invited Drs. David L. Chesler, M.D., and Jonathan M. Evans, M.D., to speak on the challenges of geriatric care from both a medical and financial point of view. Our podcast is entitled Medicare Physician Care in Jeopardy. Gene Davis introduced today's speakers.
Now, I want to introduce Gordon Walker. No, he's somewhere. There he is. Gordon, as you know, is director of the Jefferson Area Board for Aging, and is very, very well known across the whole state of Virginia, probably in the nation for that matter. Anyway, Gordon is a member of the Senior Statesman of Virginia, and he proposed this program. So since he proposed the program, we made him the moderator. Gordon, will you come up here, please?
It's wonderful to be here and see so many people I've known over the years and have the opportunity to introduce two good friends, colleagues, and one who's been my personal physician for 26 or 27 years, so I figured I'd give him a head start on his getting ready for me when I became a geriatric patient. And I don't even know at what point you become a geriatric patient in your lifetime. But I've got 4 years, and I'll be eligible for Medicare, so maybe that's when I qualify. One other thing I've noted in the past when I've been asked to do this role is that you really don't need a moderator here because you are such a courteous group of people, and the flow of information back and forth tends to work okay if that's okay. And also it's because I've been asked to, some people are coming in from out of town and I got to be at a 2:30 meeting. That's the other reason. But more importantly, I don't. If you need me, I'll play that role until 2:30. One thing I'd like to share with you in doing a little bit of research in preparation for introducing Jonathan and Dave is there are 7,000 geriatricians in the United States. Basically one for every 5,000 people. And that the challenge is that there doesn't seem to be any argument about the fact that by the year 2030, we're going to need five times as many geriatricians. In other words, 36,000. Locally, the ratio is a little bit better. It's about one for every 4,000 people over the age of 65. In part, that's due to the good work that Jonathan has, really gone out and tried to sell the geriatric program at UVA. He's brought more geriatricians on staff. We're fortunate at JABA that we've got an excellent geriatric practice right in our building there. It was the idea of one-stop shopping for people so they could access JABA services, but it's great to have UVA's geriatric practice there. We think that helps consumers a lot. And one other thing I noted when I was doing a little bit of research on this, I don't know if people really know this, but 20% of hospital admissions are really due to problems related to medications. People either taking too many or not taking enough or not being able to afford what they needed or whatever it may be. But a recent study came out and indicated that people are much less likely to be admitted to a hospital for issues related to medication issues if they have a geriatrician as their physician. So I scratch my head and I say, okay, why is this? Well, what I concluded was, and really it's in large part due to the excellent social work activities that I think geriatricians offer. Again, Dr. Chesler is a geriatrician. We always say he's a licensed geriatrician. I don't know how to say it elsewhere. But he's played a social worker role for me. I had a problem once. I had to be in the hospital. They wanted to do multiple tests. And if I didn't have Dave by my side making certain that I got these tests done just like this, to make sure that I didn't spend any more time in the hospital than I needed, that I got the medications that I required, that I got out of there as quick as I could, and so on and so forth. Who knows what the outcome would have been? And I think this underscores, and Jonathan and I were talking about this yesterday, is they're not just very skilled at the practice of medicine, but it's very important that they understand how the support system works for people that need their assistance. And I know they're going to be talking more and more about this, but it really relates to how to be engaged in family-related issues, be knowledgeable about what the community has to offer in the way of services to help people. So where it really is a team sport, in my view, the practice of geriatric care, and it's critical that you have a really good quarterback there in charge of making certain the team moves down the field together in a uniform way. And I think we're so fortunate that we have in our community doctors like Dave and Jonathan practicing geriatric medicine, because as you get older, the complexities associated with providing care are greater. But also, sadly, the system of healthcare is becoming increasingly more complex. So we need to have people that have the kind of backgrounds that they offer. So I'm going to step back, introduce Dr. Chesler and Jonathan Evans. You received bio information on them already, so I don't think it's necessary for me to underscore what brings them to be here today. But I do want to say that our community is a much better place for people to age as a result of having them practicing medicine in our community. And I don't know who wants to go first. Okay, Dave, you go first.
Hi. What I thought I'd do is to give you sort of my perspective of primary care. Geriatrics is primary care for people that are older than me. And but it becomes much more complicated just because of the nature of the patients and the kind of problems they have and the social issues. And as Gordon said, this need for a quarterback, for somebody that can help a person be guided through the healthcare system is very important. But just a little bit about my background. I came to Virginia in 1977 as a volunteer in the National Health Care Service, and I was working out in Louisa County, where I thought I was going to be one of three doctors. I ended up being basically the only adult provider of medical care for about a year and a half. So I ended up doing a little bit of everything except delivering babies. And I did that for 3 years. And I really enjoyed it, and I enjoyed primary care, but as a trained internist, I really missed doing the hospital work. And I found that I really was not happy that I turned the care over to somebody else when my patient was really sick and I thought needed me. And I felt that the continuity of care that I could provide, I thought, was very important. So in 1980, I came to Charlottesville and went into practice here, and then joined the staff in the Martha Jefferson Hospital, and I've been doing that since 1980. And the practice that we have, it's a little different model than what some people use, and I think I'm a little bit of a dinosaur because our philosophy does invoke this idea of continuity of care, so that we take care of our patients whether they're in the office or they're in the hospital or if they go into a nursing home or assisted living. And I think there's some good aspects to that. I think there's certainly more patient satisfaction. I think as just a case with Gordon, I think that when the same person who knows you and knows all your problems is also there with you when you're the sickest, and can interact with your family, and especially when there's a lot of major big decisions to be made, sometimes about whether to end care or how care should be, what direction it should go. I think it's good to have a familiar face. The handing off of patient care has problems. There are more mistakes, especially in medications. I think at times it can be more expensive because there's duplication. People talk a lot about the electronic medical record as a tool for ameliorating that. And I think it helps to some extent, but there's just things about a person that you know, that you learn, that's part of your relationship that that you bring to the table that I think is very beneficial for the patient, and they appreciate it. And I think in the end, it leads to a better job. I mean, there's probably some drawbacks to that. I think for a lot of physicians, it's financially difficult. If you only have a couple patients in the hospital, it's not very cost effective to go all across town and see the patient and maybe get interrupted in the middle of the day because there's an emergency. And I think that's why, if we look at what's going on in our town and nationally, that patients tend not to be taken care of in the hospital by their primary care physician. Certainly, if somebody only has a few people in the hospital, they tend to be less efficient, which makes them it actually drives the cost up for the hospital because patients stay in there longer. The model that we use is a little different. We do have a large hospital practice, and we hospitalize for a number of physicians in outlying counties. So we have a larger hospital service. We're much more efficient at what we do. Unfortunately, that's just not possible for a lot of other practices. That has led to the development of what are called hospitalists. And so now, and it's pretty much uniformly around the country, that more and more there's a group of internists who have chosen to not do any outpatient primary care, and they just work in the hospital. There's a lot of reasons for that. There's no business hassles because they're usually employed by a hospital. They get paid more because the hospital can subsidize their salaries, and they look at the fact that because they're doing more hospital care, they're keeping the length of stay down, and that makes more money for the hospital. So they can certainly justify that. Some people, I think there's a little change, I think, in attitude. Maybe people are more interested in the child rearing that maybe we didn't see a generation ago, and so the physicians want to be home with the kids too, and not just the spouse. And oftentimes the spouse is a professional, has their own career, and so there's this need to share. But I just wanted to kind of sort of talk about this a little bit and mention how primary care has sort of changed a little bit in this. We have this general loss of continuity. I don't see that reverting at all. Although with hospitalists, it's becoming harder to find them. I know the Martha Jefferson has had trouble recruiting, and I've talked to people in other states where they've really had trouble keeping enough hospitalists around to provide 24-hour, 7-day services in taking care of patients. One thing about primary care and there's certainly a number of physicians who have chosen to work for foundations or hospitals because they don't want to put up with the hassle of dealing with insurances, and so they find some satisfaction in that. But for the private practitioner, and I'm talking more about people in primary care. It's still a small business, and so you have overhead, and you have salaries, and you have employees, and you have workman's comp, and all the same things that that all the other businesses have to deal with. One of the big differences, though, is even though this is a capitalistic system, in medicine you can't pass on increased costs to the consumer. If Kroger's is paying more to get a case of beans, they can pass it on. Physicians can't do that. In the last 10 years, we've seen this some tremendous increases in malpractice insurance, and of course, we have We have employees that are dedicated, and we want to pay them adequately and give them benefits as well. And that becomes increasingly hard when you're locked into systems where you can't pass increased costs on. You can only get what the insurance companies want you to get. Now, that's a big problem because Medicare is sort of sets the gold standard for how they're going to reimburse people. If you look at contracts that we often have to make with outlying insurance companies, if you look at their fee schedules, they're often set as percentages of the Medicare fee. So if Medicare goes up a little bit, you might get a little bit more reimbursement for the other insurance companies as well. And if it goes down, then I guess we would have to worry about that. Of course, I think a lot of you know as a small business person, if you're trying to plan, you budget your business, plan for the future, it's kind of hard to do when there's always this threat of a cut looming over your head. And that's what Congress has done to medicine for a number of years now. And it's always right at the last hour that they'll change it and postpone it. And now we have this big postponement that's gone on since the end of the year that is coming up. And what physicians are faced with is a 10% cut. Now, what does that mean? Well, primary care, your overhead runs about 60%. So let's say you're a geriatrician and all you do is Medicare. So if your salary and benefits comes out of that 40%, if you cut 10%, it doesn't make any difference about your overhead. You still got to pay that. So that 10% comes out of the 40%. So that means a 25% cut in your salary and benefits. So if I was a new graduate coming out, it would certainly scare me to look at primary care as a career choice. I finally graduated to reading glasses here. So, primary care, probably more than I think a lot of the other specialties, has a lot of problems inherent to it. It's a lot busier. If you look at where most of your health care is going, who's actually providing it, the hands-on stuff, that's primary care. So most of your diabetes and your hypertension and your asthma and your emphysema is really being managed by primary care people. There's a lot of hassles that go into it, most of it because of insurances. The insurances feel, and I think it's rightly true, that if you have good gatekeepers to keep people out of the emergency rooms, to try to keep them away from specialists, it's cheaper for the system, and they make more money. And I think that's true, but in order to enforce that, then what we see is a lot of hassles that we have to have in terms of referrals and getting tests that we think are appropriate. There's often roadblocks that are put up that we have to jump over in order to get certain medicines that we think are right. And the insurance companies have a way of hassling you that it's real easy just to give up your hands and cave in. But it's that sort of thing that really irks a lot of people and I think keeps people out of primary care. The specialists tend to enjoy a little bit nicer lifestyle. They're not called 24 hours a day. We're on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and a lot of that's mandated by the insurance companies that we have, in order to be on a panel, we have to be able to provide that service. Primarily so that, again, it helps keep people out of the emergency rooms because you're available and can give counsel. But as I'm sure you're all aware, because that's why you're here, that we have this big access problem. In this country, we have tens of millions of people that are uninsured. And that obviously creates an access. But I think even worse than that is the shortage of primary care physicians. This country is not, and not just geriatricians, which is, I know, a big focus here, and I think Jonathan will talk more specifically about that, but just primary care in general. These are the people that do the preventative care and the health maintenance and help people reduce risk factors and identify risk factors that keep them healthier longer, and it's cheaper and better for the system. It costs everybody a lot less. But that's not where our emphasis is. And our system makes it harder and harder for people to want to enter primary care. And this is not something that's going to be fixed anytime soon. It's going to take a long time to change the mindset and to get people interested into going back into primary care. But just to give you some example of some statistics, in 1998, 54% of third-year internal medicine residents. So these were the internal medicine residencies were 3 years. So these are the people that are getting ready to go out. 54% of them were planning to do primary care in 1998. 8 years later, in 2006, that number dropped to 26%. So it cut in half. If we looked at fourth-year medical students and asked them what were they interested in doing. In 1999, about a little over 12% said that they were planning to do primary care internal medicine or primary care in general. By 2004, so just 5 years later, that percentage dropped to 4.4%. In general, there's about 4,800 internal medicine slots in the country. Now, it sounds like a lot, but unfortunately, the majority of those people go on to do subspecialty work. So they'll do their 3 years of internal medicine, but then they'll go into gastroenterology, or they'll go into hematology, or cardiology, or GI. Much nicer lifestyles, and they all make a lot more money. For some reason, Medicare and insurance companies in general find it a lot easier to put a price tag on a surgical procedure than they do on cognitive functioning. So to see someone with five or six problems on six or seven medications with all the polypharmacy and hazards that go with it, it's a lot easier to put the price tag on doing an endoscopy or a cardiac cath. And that's the kind of thing that's going to have to change. And actually, if you look at primary care internal medicine and you look at the residency programs, there's only about 260 slots nationally that are dedicated primary care internal medicine. Now, of that, about 60% of those are filled by Americans, American-trained physicians. The rest are people that have trained in outside the U.S. That's typical of the healthcare residencies that we have here. I think, generally speaking, we're very much dependent on people coming from other countries in order to fill our residency slots. I think most of the residencies would probably fold if we weren't bringing people in. And I think the problem I have with that is that it's not that we invite people in because they're the best trained and the smartest and the brightest. We can't function without them. And I think that says something about our system. I used to think that our medical system here was sort of the crown in our the jewel in our crown, and I think we've sort of lost that. But I just have a couple of comments, and I'll shut up here. But I think as a nation, our success and our security in this world really depends on making sure that we have an educated public and we have a healthy public. When our healthcare dollars are as limited as they are, personally, I have to ask the question, why should there be any profit on it? We have huge administrative costs that go into that suck out healthcare dollars, about 20 to 25%. There was a time when the administrative costs for the whole Canadian healthcare system were less an administrative cost for the state of Massachusetts. So for me, that's an issue, and I don't know if it's something the politicians would ever be able to tackle. I don't think anybody has the guts to do it. One other thing, and this is just a feeling I have about the Medicare system, which everybody tells us is going to go broke, and it probably won't because somebody's going to fix it because they'll never get elected again if they don't. But during our working years when we're paying into Medicare, in a sense it's means tested because the more you make, the more Medicare tax you pay. And that's okay, and I think that's right to do that. But once we hit 65 or 66, whenever we retire, and we go on to Medicare, we enter this level playing field. And yeah, I remember one day I was in the office and I was taking care of a guy who was an ex-CEO of a Fortune 500 company. And the next person I saw, who was also retired and on Medicare, the best he could do in life was work in a sawmill. And he was living on $500 a month, which is what Social Security paid him. And yet the two of them were paying the exact same health care premiums. And that just doesn't make sense. I think that's certainly one place where Medicare could go to help. And it wouldn't really take, certainly if we were just trying to fix primary care, it wouldn't really take it wouldn't take anything more than small co-pays that would be attached to your, which would be graded depending on what your income is. But there's a lot of seniors that still have a pretty reasonable income. And $5 or $10 extra, which would amount to probably less than $200 a year, would make such a huge difference in reimbursement for a primary care doctor who's seeing 20 to 25 patients a day, that just that alone would make primary care a lot more attractive. But that would just be one solution. I'll look forward to questions later in the afternoon.
Well, good afternoon. First of all, I agree with everything my friend and colleague, Dr. Chesler, said, and I'm not in the habit of agreeing with doctors, so somewhat exceptional. Thank you for having me. I wanted to, first of all, thank you for changing your bylaws so that now I can join your organization. I have my membership fee here. The AARP turned me down, so I have been interested in your organization for some time for rather vain reasons, okay? My friend and erstwhile mentor, Dick Lindsay, has been very active in this organization, and so to me, I thought this must be a really hot ticket, and I thought I made the big time if I'm here now, because usually you just have him. And for any of you that won't be able to make it to the debate tonight at the Miller Center, let me just offer my own opinion on the issue of healthcare, and that is that in every civilized nation, healthcare for all is among the most basic human rights. Moreover, it's my belief that civilization itself is defined by how we care for others. So I will so I'll stay out of the way of progress on that. There are a few different things I wanted to talk to you about. I want to, or at least touch upon, and we can discuss more afterwards. I want to show you some data and talk a little bit about geriatrician and physician workforce issues in Virginia. I wanted to add to what Dr. Chesler said about primary care, and also talk about how and why doctors choose a particular specialty. I'd like to also touch on some things that I think every doctor in every specialty needs to know about the care of older patients. And then ultimately I want to talk with you about what you can do to try to improve the situation locally and throughout the state. And I'm certainly delighted to talk with any of you, honored in fact, about your own individual health concerns, but in order to avoid embarrassing either me or you, we'll talk privately afterwards. Let me just start off by saying, and this ties into what Dr. Chesler was saying about fragmented care, that in medicine, we have done to human beings what Frank Perdue has done to the chicken. Okay? Some of you may have heard me say this before, but basically we have chopped up human beings into individual pieces and sold off the parts for a lot more money than the whole. And it's gotten so young people nowadays can't even recognize a chicken, don't know how many legs or wings an actual chicken has or where it goes on the chicken. And the same is true of doctors. Some just don't know much about what a human being is. Like Dr. Chesler, I went into medicine hoping to become a human being. Okay, so that limited my choice of specialties to some extent. I have a few slides I wanted to show you. This was a report that I was asked to give to the Joint Commission on Healthcare for the Virginia State Legislature, and I just want to point out some highlights. I'll preface that by saying that the legislature is quite concerned about meeting the needs of aging Virginians, so much so that there was a legislation passed a few years ago called the Reed Bill that requires all state agencies, basically anybody that gets state funds, including the university, to give an annual report on what they're doing to meet the needs of older people. So they've essentially put agencies and universities on notice, and there's something of an accounting that has to happen every year. I want to summarize for you some of that. You can go ahead with the next slide. You can keep going. Now, 2 years ago, someone else gave the report, and what they said was that there was a national and a Virginia shortage of geriatricians, and that was projected to worsen over the coming decades, that we basically needed about 20,000 a couple years ago. There were never more than 9,000, and now that number is decreasing, largely because many people who were geriatricians retired. We need about 500 geriatricians in Virginia. A couple years ago, we had 146. That's just based on the national figures. Across the country, there are 350 geriatric training positions that are filled every year. And a year or two ago, it was said that financial disincentives posed the greatest barrier to entry into the field of geriatrics. That was 2 years ago. I'm going to give you my report from this year. Just to summarize briefly, the number of geriatricians continues to fall, but financial disincentives do not pose the greatest barrier to entry into the field of geriatrics, although those financial issues are of concern, but that the greatest barriers in the state of Virginia are attitudinal and relate also to a scarcity of training opportunities in Virginia. There are fewer than 10 geriatric physician specialty training positions available in the state of Virginia every year. So the most we could produce is 10 a year. That's despite the fact that one out of every 40 Medicare beneficiaries, it's about just shy of 900,000, live in Virginia. Okay. Here's why this matters really for all physicians, and that is that what happens as a person's, basically, human body changes throughout life, okay? It's continuously changing. I would like to think that most of those changes are good, okay? But good or bad, one has to be aware of what those changes are and respect those changes in order to be healthy and avoid harm as a result of healthcare. As an example, kidney function steadily reduces from age 30 throughout life, okay? It's still plenty good, okay? I don't want to scare anybody. But by age 80, a person has about 50% of the kidney function that they had at age 30, okay? Which basically means that if you take a medicine that's eliminated through the kidneys and you only have half as much kidney filtering, that medicine is going to last a lot longer in your system, okay? And if you keep taking the same dose in the same amount, you're going to get higher and higher levels in your body and you're going to get sick, okay? So doctors have to understand every doctor has to understand some basic things about how the body changes in order to avoid hurting people, okay? Now, I dare say that in the care of children, every doctor understands that kids are different. Most doctors are terrified of treating children unless they're pediatricians, okay? But unfortunately for adults, there's this notion that adults are all about the same adult size, and therefore one size fits all in terms of prescribing medicines and ordering treatments. And in the culture of medicine, we have been trained and conditioned to do things the same way all the time. There's a certain comfort in knowing that you're doing it the right way, okay? But unfortunately, what we really need is customized care for everybody that takes into account your individual body as well as your individual wants and needs, okay? All right, so unfortunately, our system of care wasn't actually built for older people. In fact, it wasn't even built for sick people, because our system of care requires you to decide whether you need health care or not. It's what's called a complaint-based system, okay? So no one's going to call you up and say, hey, when's the last time you went to the doctor? I think it's time, okay? Your dentist does a much, much better job in general of preventive care than the healthcare system does in you know, overall. And so the thing is, in order to be able to complain, you have to be aware of what's going on. You have to make decisions about how soon you need to be seen and by whom. So you have to be your own doctor to some extent, okay? And unfortunately, if you get sick, that renders you less able to do that. Less able to figure it out and less able to physically get to where you need to go. I guess the one thing I would add to that is that in the care of older patients, what often happens is people get undertreated, they also get overtreated. Some of that can actually happen simultaneously, particularly when you're dealing with multiple problems at once. Next slide, please. There are lots of bad consequences to basically inadequate or poor care of older patients. There's needless suffering, we waste a lot of money, there's overuse of emergency rooms, as was discussed, and basically it costs more to the state. It's not in the best interest of the state or the country to have people less healthy than they could be. Okay, next please. In this academic year, there were 7 geriatric physician trainees in Virginia. And I've talked to people in leadership positions at the 3 major university medical schools and teaching hospitals. And frankly, until very recently, if that, geriatrics was not part of the strategic plan for any of them. Okay? Now, that being said, and these are all public documents, so don't take my word for it, okay? That being said, the strategic plan for each of the major hospitals is to take care of people who are having cardiac surgery or orthopedic surgery, okay, which is primarily older people, okay? So the hospitals themselves understand that the money for them is in the care of older patients with certain specific problems. However, there is the same ignorance on the part of hospitals about how to take care of older people. And the assumption is, well, if you are a cardiac surgeon, then you know everything there is to know about the care of older cardiac surgery patients. And the proof of that is you treat them all the same way, okay? So as a consequence, there really is no widely held belief that there's a need for change, okay? The other thing you have to understand is that the culture within healthcare is one of fear and a reverence for the status quo. Not even the status quo, but this imagined glorious past of decades ago, all right? Which we complained about at the time, okay? it's been said that people who live in a golden age go around complaining about how everything looks yellow. But the thing is, because there is so much uncertainty about whether payments to hospitals and physicians are gonna be cut, that really doesn't encourage people to take risks and to make significant changes because you might guess wrong. The other thing is that there are a lot of, thanks for moving me along here, I appreciate that. There are a lot of negative attitudes, unfortunately, towards older people, okay? I mean, from the standpoint of physicians and nurses, I mean, this has been studied, okay? Quite frankly, for young physicians in training, it's often overwhelming to take care of anybody, and they're taught to deal with one problem at a time. So when confronted with a situation where there are multiple problems simultaneously that interrelate to one another, frankly, that's sort of the Friday or Saturday edition of the New York Times crossword puzzle, okay? It's more complicated than than they necessarily signed up for. And for some people, that's not a lot of fun. For other people, it's, you know, it's the only fun, okay? But unfortunately, it's also been shown, they've done studies of medical students and nursing students at the beginning of their training, and then the same individuals a year or more later as they've gotten more and more experience and gotten more training. And what they've found is that they come into a medical education with negative attitudes, and those attitudes actually get worse as they get more, as they're taught more. And the reason for that is these negative attitudes are being taught to them, okay? And that's something that we are trying to change, okay? Now, some of that, frankly, comes from the fact that 20 years ago, 15 years ago, Medicare was in the forefront of actually, if you'll pardon the expression, price fixing, okay, of setting fees, okay, when before that, physicians charged whatever their usual and customary fee was. And so for a long time, there was a move away from Medicare, and it's still the case now that many people in many parts of the country will have great difficulty finding a healthcare provider because many practices won't take people on Medicare or won't take any additional Medicare patients. The good news is that's changed a lot in the last 5 years because all the other insurance companies are way worse than Medicare, okay? So Medicare has become the preferred provider for every hospital in the country, okay? But it was often the case when I lived in Minnesota and had many patients who spent the winter in Texas or Florida or Arizona that I had to be their doctor over the phone because they couldn't get even basic health care if they got sick away from home. All right, here's the thing. Medical training, for all we like to think about it, is really an apprenticeship, okay? That's been the tradition for a long time. And almost as proof of that, you can tell the age of a physician by the drugs they prescribe, because they're the drugs those are the habits that they learned and developed while they were residents, okay? And it's been shown that the choice of specialty is highly, highly influenced by role modeling and mentorship, okay? So in other words, I mean, take me for example. I mean, there are certainly, I had classmates who came out of the egg wanting to be a neurosurgeon or something like that. Those people, you pretty much, not neurosurgeons, but people who have an idea that they want to do something long before they know what that is, probably shouldn't do that thing. But at any rate, for me, I come from a long line of bad patients. I don't have any doctors in my family. So I was influenced very much by my family's experience in going to the doctor, you know, my idea of what a doctor was. I didn't have, I had the usual childhood illnesses, but I didn't have any, I wasn't diabetic. I didn't have cancer or anything like that. So I didn't know what all these different specialties were. I tried to go to school with an open mind. There were certain specialties that I thought should be very appealing, for various reasons, The ones that everybody thinks are hot, like radiology or dermatology and stuff. No offense to anybody here, but they were boring. Radiology was like watching black and white TV all day long, okay? All right? One of the teachers I had in radiology, his real love in life was trout fishing, okay? I like to fish too, so I kind of related to that. But he spent every waking minute all day long, most of the time at work, thinking about and planning what he was going to do the next weekend. And he would, the guy made a lot of money. He would fly out to Montana and fish these famous streams every weekend and then fly back and go to work, all right? And I thought to myself, I want to love what I do. I want to look forward to going to work. I don't want to wish away most of my life hoping for that few hours, of joy some other time. So, all right. But, for me, basically, I went to medical school thinking I was going to pediatrics, okay? Of course, the old joke in geriatrics is that, the only difference is the size of the diapers, but, But, that being said, I was very influenced by, a teacher that I had early on in medical school who was sort of the first person that I met as a doctor that sort of fit the image of what I thought being a doctor was. For me, being a doctor is a journey of sort of self-improvement, okay? It's self-discovery. Actually, it's not my self. It's other people's improvement. The self-improvement's too hard, but if you all would just get busy improving, then I'm digressing slightly. So the thing is, if the way that people choose which kind of doctor they're going to be is based on exposure to other doctors, then of course, if the curriculum is full of every other organ and specialty, then of course you're going to have lots of cardiologists and lots of gastroenterologists and so forth. And culturally, that's the cool, exciting stuff for a lot of people. You know, that's the stuff on TV, all these innovative technologies, okay? You listen to the radio and they talk about UVA's slogan on is something like, all those, you know, cutting-edge technologies that you read about, well, we've got those, okay? You know, I mean, they don't say, you know, we have a couple nice guys here and they like, you know, and they just love to talk to you, you know what I mean? They don't say that, okay? Who cares about that, right? There's some good news in all this, by the way. I'm just getting to the punchline. But all right, you know, less than a quarter of all medical schools nationwide required a geriatric rotation. Okay, as of late, only a third of residency programs had specific geriatric requirements. And when medical schools were asked, why don't you have geriatrics in your curriculum? The number one reason given was curriculum conflicts, meaning that everybody's baby is beautiful, right? Okay, so naturally, the biochemistry people feel that that's a critical foundation for medical education. And naturally, you know, as all these technologies have been introduced in medical care, that takes time to learn about those, okay? So even though it's not in there much, when you look at family medicine and internal medicine residency programs, which are basically the primary care specialties, geriatrics is rated as the second most important curriculum area. Critical care was actually rated as number one, okay? So... And, you know, it's one thing to actually train 7 or 10 geriatric doctors a year. It's another thing to keep them, okay? It's absolutely true what was said about, foreign medical graduates. If we didn't have foreign medical graduates working in hospitals in this country, many hospitals, most community hospitals, would have to close, okay? Certainly in urban areas. I mean, you can think of it to some extent as cheap labor. Now, fortunately, many of them get superb education elsewhere, but not all, okay? But even so, they come here on student, you know, they're technically given a student visa. Being a resident physician is considered to be a graduate student. And so after their residency is done, they have to go home, okay? So we're contributing to train excellent doctors who can't stay here even if they wanted to, for the most part. We had a geriatric physician who trained here. He ended up he wanted to stay. He ended up working in what's considered a federally underserved area. He went to Western Maryland with the promise that if he did that for 3 years, he'd get a green card and be able to come back here and be a geriatrician. Well, that was about 6 or 7 years ago, you know, and he's still waiting for his green card, even though he's done his time. That's a major issue as well. And the thing about it is that there are so many geriatric jobs that are unfilled that even if we trained as many as we could, we may still have trouble keeping them just because many people might consider their opportunities elsewhere, okay? All right, here's some good news. Locally, the number of geriatricians has expanded. We have a net increase of 4 geriatricians over the last 5 years at UVA, and we have another physician starting in a couple of weeks, and we have two positions that are being advertised currently. So we are planning to add as many geriatric physicians as we can, basically. There's an increased interest in geriatrics among medical students and resident physicians in Virginia. We've actually had, we have a faculty physician who did her residency and her fellowship here. You know, she got interested early on and was mentored for a number of years, so people don't necessarily have to leave, and similarly, we don't have to recruit from all over the place. The other thing is that even though there are significant reimbursement issues, Medicare has increased reimbursement for primary care visits in office settings and in a nursing home over the last 2 years, and there's an increase in the number of geriatric training positions. I might also add some local good news that after I threw a tantrum and threatened to quit, not that this is related in any way, but the hospital, sometime after that, not cause and effect by any means, actually provided funding for a second geriatric fellowship position, okay? They would have funded 2 more positions if I agreed to quit, but that's another story. The other thing is that that the School of Medicine here has actually decided that they feel that geriatrics is so important to the training for every physician that they are going to start in the spring of next year adding required geriatric training for every medical student at UVA, which is 140, it'll be 160 students a year. Okay? Now, over a four-year period, that works out to about $1 million in funding from the University School of Medicine toward geriatric education. So that's a that's not an insignificant investment that they're making. So that, you know, that in and of itself makes it easier to recruit physicians, and it makes, you know, and it does a lot to change the culture and change attitudes, because every single student now is going to be, at least for a period of a couple of weeks, is going to be tutored and mentored by a geriatric physician. And part of our goal there is actually to get them out of the hospital so that they can see care across the continuum of care. Okay. So basically, we've got too few geriatricians here. There aren't enough training positions to replace retiring physicians, but there is increased interest. Okay. I think that the problem and the responsibility for inadequate training and not enough faculty really lies within those institutions, okay? And but the problems of care for older physicians aren't limited to those training sites by any means, okay? So I think in order to make a change, we have to influence those institutions, okay? Next slide, please. I think there's a few more, actually, even though it says summary. Next one, please. So the question is, how could you actually increase more geriatricians? Well, you could increase the number of training positions, which basically means you have to pay money to fund additional training positions and salaries and so forth. Or you have to come up with ways to keep more people, which is by addressing these immigration and, you know, visa issues, as well as creating financial incentives like loan repayment for physicians who do spend some time doing geriatrics. That deals directly with the issue of the financial incentive. You know, basically, if people graduate from medical school with $100,000 or $200,000 in debt, you know, they're probably not going to join the Peace Corps, you know, unless they declare personal bankruptcy, okay? The other thing is, you know, we can try to, recruit and find more, provided we have more positions for them. I don't want to belabor this except to say that the state of Virginia pays money to all of the teaching hospitals every year. You know, two things. Number one, the state pays money to all the teaching hospitals every year. Number two, there are 1,000 physicians in training at the university in about 100 different specialty training areas, okay? And the money for all those positions, even though only two of them are for, 2 out of 1,000 are geriatrics, the money for all those training positions comes from Medicare. Okay? And the formula is based on how many Medicare patients use that particular hospital. Okay? So in other words, through your Medicare premiums, you are paying to train all the physicians in the country. Okay? A fraction of which are focusing on getting the special skills and, you know, and tools they need to take care of you, okay? And I think if you just were to demand collectively that a little bit more of that, maybe increase it from 0.5% to 0.75%, go toward, you know, the care of older people, that would make a gigantic difference, okay? Similarly, the money that goes to hospitals from the state of Virginia primarily goes to pay for people without insurance, which is mostly younger people, okay? But if only 0.5% of that went specifically toward training and the care of older people, that would make a huge difference, okay? So I think that's all I'm going to say about that. Let me just answer one of the questions that I posed earlier, which is, what does every doctor need to know about the care of older patients, okay? All right. First of all, I mentioned you have to know the basics about what happens to a person's body over time, particularly as it relates to drug prescribing. And I could teach you that in 10 minutes, and you'd be an expert on it. And you'd have 10 minutes more training than most doctors, okay? doctors also have to understand healthcare delivery. Okay, and basically, here's what it boils down to. Doctors are trained only in the things that doctors do, okay? Everything's been cut up into little tiny pieces, okay? But to take care of you, you know, it means taking care of all the pieces, okay? So doctors need to know what all those other pieces are and who's doing it, okay? They need to be able to communicate with them, and ultimately, and this is really what distinguishes primary care from other fields, is a primary care physician is the one that, first of all, takes responsibility for you, okay? And second, is proud of it, okay? That, you know, as opposed to saying, I mean, I spent, you know, 17 winters at Mayo Clinic, okay? And, you know, there were, thousands and thousands of doctors there in all specialties. And, you know, basically, oftentimes what would happen, I mean, you wouldn't see one doctor, you see 10, okay? And if you had chest pain or something like that, and you happen to see a cardiologist, let's say, you'd have a million tests done, and ultimately they'd say something like, well, the good news is your heart's fine. Oh, that's great, doc, but why am I having chest pain? Well, I don't know, but the good news is it's not your heart, okay? But what would I do now? I mean, I'm still having this chest pain. I told you it's not your heart, okay? You know what I mean? Okay? So that's the problem, okay? Doctors need to understand what Medicare is, okay? I ask young physicians this all the time, okay? They don't get any training in what Medicare is, okay? How can I be your advocate? How can I get you what you need and what you're entitled to if I don't know what you're entitled to, okay? Like things like durable medical equipment, you know, things like skilled nursing care, you know, home health. If I don't know what the rules are for you to qualify for that, you're the one that suffers, okay? Similarly, every one of you probably has, that's old enough anyway, has Medicare Part D and has, you know, some complex and arcane insurance plan. Well, you know, I could end up costing you a lot of money out of ignorance if I didn't know what the drugs were that were covered and so forth, okay? Fundamentally, doctors that are taking care of older patients need to know what patients want, what older patients want and need. Now, the easiest way, I'm still testing this hypothesis, but I believe that the easiest way to know what an older patient wants and needs is to ask them, okay? So, but that means that doctors have to be taught how to listen, okay? I was taught how to interrogate people, okay? How to extract the maximum amount of information in the minimum amount of time with none of the extra stuff that I shouldn't want to know about, okay? Similarly, doctors taking care of older patients need to learn how to communicate not only with older patients and their families, but with other healthcare providers. So there's a basic skill set that every doctor needs to know to care for older patients. But the thing is, that's a basic skill set that every doctor needs to know to take care of anybody, okay? And those basic skills are not part of medical education. So my argument is that if we train people to focus on the care of older people, we will improve care for everybody, okay? All right, I talked too long, I'm sorry. Okay. I will sit down and take whatever you have to give.
I think we need to get a really big round of applause for these two men. And the primary care physicians essentially are the least paid physicians in the country. And these are our family medicine physicians and our internal medicine physicians. If you go into geriatrics, you go into geriatrics and are certified after you complete your training and board certification in either family medicine or internal medicine. These people are the ones who are the responsible repositories of the reports from all the other physicians, from your cardiology, urology, dermatology. All those physicians, once they see you, are supposed to report to your primary care. Not always they do, but that's what they're supposed to do. Geriatricians have a really problem right now, and people, any physician who sees a geriatric patient, because Medicare is trying, or the federal government is trying to cut the Medicare payments to any physician who treats a Medicare patient by 5 to 10%. This has gone on from Budget Reform Act. And right now, in the Senate of the United States, there is a bill to cut that, and to other bill to waive that cut. And I have been given an 800 number to call the Virginia senators. I don't have it with me right now, but if you give me your email or your phone number, I will be happy to give it to you tonight, because it's really important to call our senators and say, do not cut the Medicare payments to any physician. So give me your information and I'll get the information back to you. Okay, now just a minute, we'll get up. Do you have it? Okay. Would you give it to Peyton?
Pay issue, and this is a issue that obviously comes up every year. Let me first of all say, I didn't come here with a tip jar. Okay, my goal in here wasn't to raise money for me. Okay, and you know, my income is probably in the top 1% of all Americans. Okay, so I'm not a rich man. But I'm very fortunate, okay, and it's definitely a privilege to practice medicine. But by the same token, because physicians make more money than most people, we're also kind of an easy target, because it seems like, well, you're just taking money, you know, from greedy rich doctors anyway, okay. The reason why you should care about this issue is it's really fundamentally an access to care issue. Okay, unfortunately, the less money Medicare pays for care, the less care and the lower quality of care that will be. Okay, but I have to say that somewhat guardedly, because if the only time that doctors march on the State House or Congress is to get more money for doctors, then we're really not being the patient advocates that we must be, and maybe we don't deserve more. Okay, but fundamentally, the pay cut issue matters more to my patients than it does to me. And I would encourage you to make sure that you get everything that you've paid for your whole life through your Medicare taxes.
I have a comment rather than a question, but first of all, I have no question about the fact that there is greater need for more geriatricians. But I come from a background of having worked with manpower studies for my specialty of dermatology for over 20 years. And I interacted with the GEMINAC Commission, National Commission looking at workforce needs for physicians. And I'm going to say that I'm very pessimistic that you're going to get a large increase in the number of geriatricians. What I think you have to look for here is an alternate way. And I think you're going to need to look for more use of physician extenders. Nurse practitioners, physician's assistants, I think you're going to have to look at alternate ways of delivering care, greater use of telemedicine. Right now, Medicare does not reimburse for telemedicine except for rural physicians, but I think there are a number of these communities right now within our own community, places like University Village and Branchlands and Westminster Canterbury, where telemedicine programs could be set up at those facilities with geriatricians' offices, and greater efficiency of use of the geriatrician's time and effort. I don't think you're going to get the number of geriatricians you're going to need. The need is going to be enormous. I think you're going to have to look at alternate ways of improving the efficiency of the care that you deliver through using physician extenders and other methods to improve the efficiency of the care that you deliver.
I fundamentally agree with most of the things that you said. And if I had a choice between training or hiring more geriatricians and making sure that every healthcare practitioner, doctor, nurse, I won't go down the whole long list of licensed professionals, but if I would be willing to quit being a geriatrician, okay, as most of my colleagues would too, if every other doctor were qualified to do things like prescribe drugs to older patients, just had the basic training, and were interested in doing so. I mean, it's doctors that keep me in business, quite frankly, okay? It's not necessarily a rush of patients that say, my doctor stinks, I want a geriatrician. It's basically doctors screwing up that say, this person's not doing well, can you help us figure out what's wrong? They're on 37 medicines, and, you know, at any rate, and there's no question that first of all, looking beyond geriatrics per se, there is a serious workforce shortage for healthcare professionals. Right now in this country, there is a shortage of 800,000 registered nurses, okay? And that number is expected to increase to 3 million, okay? And there is a terrible shortage of physicians. It happens to be greatest within primary care because, unfortunately, the role of primary care physicians is more difficult to duplicate with technology than other things. Moreover, while I've used telemedicine, and I think there's many, many applications for that. In fact, I dare say that what's starting to happen now is people are having some of their medicine or some of their physician services provided by doctors who are physically in other countries, okay, who can read your EKG or your X-ray and that sort of stuff. So, you know, that increases the market even further for lots of things because the television doesn't have to be in Virginia. It can be in Bhopal, India, okay? But fundamentally, my concern about telemedicine and technology with regard to the care of older people is twofold. Number one, I don't want a situation where you get a doctor and you get a TV, okay? I don't want a system where because people are older, they somehow have to settle for less, okay? The second thing is there is a ton of things that can be done with technology to basically increase productivity to deal with workforce issues. But what I want the most, ultimately, is loving care. Okay, and it doesn't have to be from a doctor by any means, but I want loving care from a human being. All right, and if I'm in a nursing home, I don't want the latest, greatest technology. I want somebody that I trust who's going to treat me lovingly. Okay, and so I think there's a lot we can do with technology, but fundamentally, technology is not going to improve attitudes. Okay, and it's not going to take the place of good attitudes or knowledge, okay? So we have to start with the basics and making sure that we're creating a system where people go into medicine because they truly care for one another. In other countries, like in England, geriatricians, there's lots of geriatricians. They're highly regarded by their peers. They make more money, okay? But in England, the National Health Service actually pays more for older patients because they're more complicated. Okay, so the system we have is the system we have, but it's also the system we made. It doesn't have to be that way.
My concern is probably not so much with technology as it is the use of physician extenders. And I want to ask you, what effort is being made to increase the number of nurse practitioners and physician's assistants who are dedicated to geriatric and primary care? Because these people can be extremely effective, and if they're trained well, they can provide the loving care. I have a daughter who's a PA. So, you know, I mean, I'm very well much aware of the fact that you don't have to have a doctor to lay the hands on every person who's sick.
I agree. I don't want to belabor this, but let me just say that, in fact, at UVA, they've just added a new nurse practitioner training program. So, you know, the number of training positions is increasing. But one of the reasons why there's such a critical shortage of nurses is there's a critical shortage of nursing faculty. And it used to be that, frankly, that women were excluded from the opportunity to be doctors. Now, most medical schools, the entering class is more than 50% female. Okay, so the pool of people that are interested in becoming nurse practitioners is actually smaller than the pool of people that are interested in becoming physicians. But there's no question that and there are lots of different terms, but nurse practitioners and PAs, other mid-level providers, are critical to meeting the care needs of older people, and in many ways far more qualified than physicians. I'm not here to say we just need more doctors and they should all take care of geriatrics. I've met a few doctors that shouldn't be practicing medicine, and many of my patients have said the same thing about me. So I'm not here to say we just, if only there were more doctors, everything would be wonderful, okay? But these are societal issues, these are complicated issues that, but I guess what I would simply say is that just from the standpoint of who the patients are and are going to be, anybody in healthcare needs to have adequate training to care for older people. And to the extent that being a physician, being a nurse, being any licensed practitioner is a privilege that has to be earned, every day, you know, part of that is earned by having professional and caring attitudes toward people. I'm starting to rant now, so I'll pass the microphone here.
On July 1st, that's only 19 days away. The law has already been passed last fall or late in the year. On January 1st, it was supposed to be effective that 10% of what is paid to your primary care physician was decreased. However, through online signatures of letters and through phone calls to this very important 1-888 toll-free number, it was delayed for 6 months. Now the push is for Senate Bill 3101, and that's vitally important because it will delay it another 18 months, time that we need to work. The 1-888 number is for Senators Warner and Webb. I don't want to lose my doctor because of a 10% decrease now and a 5% decrease in December, continuing until it reaches 50% less for the doctor. When I lived in North Carolina, I had a very nice letter from my endocrinologist saying, sorry, I can't treat you anymore, but the payments come too little and too late. That's about all that I want. Yes, the number is 888-434-6200. That's 888-434-6200. And ask your senator to vote yes to support Senate Bill 3101. Right.
Thank you so much. That was wonderful. And you all have to do it right away because they are really thinking about this bill right now. So when you go back, do it.
Mm-hmm. Believes that they have enough votes to override a presidential veto. However, a lot depends on the House also. So in these next 19 days, call that number, please.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Yes. One solution to the high cost of medical care would be difficult, but I think effective. Have all insured for preventative or curative care until it is deemed by an independent board that there is less than a 1% chance that treatment would lead to no better than what I call a 10% life. I have seen stated that 40 to 60% of all medical costs go to those in the last 6 months of their life, a period that leaves sad memories for their loved ones and misery, if not pain, for them. Insurance to cover such treatment would be optional for those who choose and are able to afford it. I'd be interested in your comments.
Towards those last 6 months, those are the people, the medical care, the cost is more because the problems are greater. But I think one of the things that we learn in geriatrics is there's a time to modulate. There's a time to address the medical problems according with what's going on in that patient's life, and not putting somebody through things that are fruitless or unnecessary just because you can do it. And I think that's one of the things that geriatricians kind of bring to the table that may be missing in the training of other doctors, and it's so important that And that does help to limit that. I mean, I think, you know, obviously it costs more to take care of somebody who has five or six medical problems and to keep those balanced and to maintain a quality of life than somebody who's 65 and hasn't been on any medications yet. But I think there really needs to be some limits. And in order to do that, I mean, and I think your physician who is guiding you through the healthcare system and helping you to make rational choices, I think helps to contain that.
I just want to point out as far as the let me put it this way: if we didn't do care that if we didn't provide care that was unnecessary, we would save a whole lot of money on healthcare. Okay, unfortunately, medical practice is based on this apprenticeship tradition and doing what you're told and what other people do. It's not based on scientific evidence of what works and what doesn't. Okay, there are drugs out there that don't even have any FDA-approved indications anymore that still sell thousands and thousands of prescriptions. Okay, but one of the difficulties with regard to the expensive care near the end of life is, first off, as an example, I've had many patients who have been near the end of their life many times over many years. Okay, by that I mean we're dealing primarily with chronic diseases that can get suddenly worse and be fatal, where people are basically on a plateau and then they fall off the cliff and then they may die or they may climb back up. Mm-hmm. That's different from cancer or something where people are dying by inches and you can say with a greater deal of confidence that the end of life is near. But I would say that the problem of expensive care near the end of life is a physician failure, not a patient failure. We do what we do because we can, not necessarily because we should. Okay, and we're comfortable doing it because we always do that. So that's the fundamental problem there that needs to be addressed. The other thing is that, and most of those are really hospital related, cost related to hospitalization. Now the problem is that the hospital has become the only vestige of the social safety net in this country. Okay, so consequently, people are hospitalized because of care failures, not because they're sick necessarily. Okay, if for example you provided in-home care to people near the end of life that was more than an hour a day, many of them wouldn't need to go to the hospital. Okay, but the hospital serves many roles, and you have to go through the hospital in order to qualify for many other services outside the hospital. So a lot of changes to the system would have to occur in order for us to realize all those savings.
I've been in the midst of this for some while, and I have a question, a little background. I've been looking at my computer very, very often, and I follow my medications, the things I take. I have a list of 12 or 15 that I take. I've talked with at least three different doctors with whom I take them. I've asked one doctor to be the police doctor to look after everything, and still it's been fighting, going back and saying, I think this medication is poisoning me. And so we're kind of proving it out. Now, having said all of that, how do I then get back to one of you kinds of people without getting a lot more flack from some of the people that I have, doctors I have, because I already got bit on the butt from one of them, so I'll get off with that.
Well, I for obvious reasons, perhaps, I'm much more concerned about how I behave than how my patients behave. Okay, I think that ultimately what you need is a partnership with somebody that you can educate about you, about what you want and need, and who's accountable to you. You know, I mean, I doubt that you would do the same thing or feel the same way about an accountant, for example, if he or she said, you know, I want you to really reduce your income, otherwise this this tax preparation is going to be complicated or something like that. I think that's a bad metaphor, but I think the tail is wagging the dog here. Okay, I mean the problem often is that doctors routinely refer to doctors in other specialties. You know, the attitude of many specialists toward primary care physicians is such that it leads to a certain inferiority complex among many physicians. You know, we're talking about a culture of fear where people are worried they're going to get into trouble if they do the wrong thing. And so for a doctor outside of a particular specialty to say, I'm worried about that drug that specialist gave you, there's a problem of, there's a sort of a power imbalance there that your physicians experience as well. But as long as you say you don't want to take it, then they're off the hook, okay? So, I can't tell you how many patients have said to me, gee, doc, I feel so much better after I ran out of those pills you gave me, okay? That is by far one of the biggest causes of harm in medical care. It's been estimated, there was a study that was reprinted in the Washington Post a number of years ago that before Medicare Part D, that as many as there's been a lot of talk about medical errors, and it's been estimated that as many as 100,000 people a year in this country die as a result of, in effect, medicines not being given as ordered. Okay, but the footnote to that is there are as many as 250,000 people who die a year as a result of taking medications exactly as prescribed. Okay, and the concern was that with Medicare Part D increasing access to these poisons with potentially beneficial side effects to a larger population of people, we may be causing even greater harm. Okay. Moreover, not every medicine that you take was intended to be taken for life. Okay. But what often happens is people get started on things in the hospital that they just continue and so forth. And I have to confess that in my situation, frequently when I'm taking care of somebody in a nursing home for a short period of time who's just come out of the hospital, who has some other doctor, that whether or not I stop their medicines depends on whether I'm going to continue to be their doctor, and as well as how long they're going to be there, because I don't want to screw everything up, basically, unless I'm going to be there to clean up the mess I make.
I want to agree with Dr. Wary in the fact that we're not going to be able to get a lot of geriatricians trained in our lifetime. However, I really want to congratulate Dr. Evans, because it was his efforts that got the 2-week geriatric rotation for medical students at the University of Virginia. And people have told me across the state this is critical to have every single physician know about the fact that our kidneys are slower, our liver is slower, and medications can stay in our body a lot longer. So what Dr. Evans has done for all of us is a real tribute, and I thank him so much. I'd like to thank also I'd like to thank also Dr. Chesler and Dr. Evans, because Delegate John O'Bannon, who's a physician on the Joint Healthcare Commission, told the Commonwealth Council on Aging that awareness was the way that we could get more geriatric training across the state at VCU, Eastern Medical Center, as well as UVA. Awareness from our population, and then action from our population, is a way to influence the legislature of Virginia and also the legislature of the United States in understanding the importance of geriatric medicine and the importance of Medicare funding. Thank you all for coming.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Daniels.